So that's Matthew chapter 27, and we're starting at verse 57. I'm reading through to the end of chapter 28. When it was evening, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who was also a disciple of Jesus. He went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate ordered it to be given to him, and Joseph took the body and wrapped it in a clean linen shroud and laid it in his own new tomb, which he had cut in the rock. And he rolled a great stone to the entrance of the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were there, sitting opposite the tomb. Next day, that is, after the day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered before Pilate and said, "Sir, we remember how that impostor said, while he was still alive, 'After 3 days I will rise.' Therefore, order the tomb to be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples go and steal him away and tell the people he has risen from the dead, and the last fraud will be worse than the first." Pilate said to them, "You have a guard of soldiers. Go make it as secure as you can." So they went and made the tomb secure by sealing the stone and setting a guard. Now after the Sabbath, towards the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. And behold, there was a great earthquake, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came down and rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothing white as snow. And for fear of him, the guards trembled and became like dead men. But the angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you seek Jesus who was crucified. He is not here, for he has risen, as he said. Come, see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples that he has risen from the dead, and behold, he is going before you to Galilee. There you will see him. See, I have told you." So they departed quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy and ran to tell his disciples. And behold, Jesus met them and said, "Greetings." And they came up and took hold of his feet and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee, and there they will see me." While they were going, behold, some of the guard went into the city and told the chief priests all that had taken place. And when they had assembled with the elders and taken counsel, they gave a sufficient sum of money to the soldiers and said, "Tell people his disciples came by night and stole him away while we were asleep. And if this comes to the governor's ears, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So they took the money and did as they were directed. And this story has been spread among the Jews to this day. Now the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain to which Jesus had directed them. And when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. And Jesus came and said to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I have commanded you. And behold, I am with you always, to the end of the age."
Well, good evening again. It's a real pleasure to be with you, and I'm very happy to be addressing this topic that William has suggested to me, why Jesus, among many possibilities. And I want to approach that, if you'll allow me, through the sobering but universal reality that confronts every person on earth, namely the reality of death. About 400 years ago, your poet, John Donne, penned these lines: "Death, be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so. For those who thou thinkest thou dost overthrow, die not, poor death, nor yet canst thou kill me." They're fighting words, aren't they? But they are a bit surprising. At the time that they were written, life was short and brutal for most people. Scores of women lost their lives giving birth, including John Donne's wife. And infants and children were lost to diseases that today barely warrant missing school. But even today, the poet's words seem to have an unreal air of confidence about them. Death, be not proud. Why shouldn't I be proud? Death might say. My strike rate is pretty good. There isn't a single person here who one day won't be. Why shouldn't I be proud? I don't know if you agree. I think Western culture has of late developed a rather shameful dismissiveness of the elderly. But there's still one thing that we applaud about the elderly. We applaud how they've kept death at bay, especially if they can do it for 100 years. The obituaries of those who die full of years, as the Bible would say, celebrate the fact that they lived long, they lived well, they made a contribution. Of late, I've read obituaries of several men and women in their 80s and 90s, an inventor, a conductor, an environmentalist, a writer. Be not proud, death, we want to say. They lived long and they lived well. And yet, we fear that death may be smirking still. Oh yes, death might say, they achieved much in the 90 years I gave them, but they didn't escape me for all their achievement, and not a few die young. Part of the eulogy given at the funeral of a 24-year-old, someone said he was too cool to die old. As though we would say, be not proud, death. He lived but a while, but he died cool. And we understand the grief-stricken attempt to make sense of something that seems so senseless, and we want to say with him, be not proud, death, but it seems a little hollow. We want to say, be not proud, death, so we say of those who die, they're out of their suffering now. We want to say, be not proud, death, so we call a funeral a celebration of a life. We want to say, be not proud, death, so we campaign for euthanasia, a word which literally means good death. We'll rob death of pride, we think, if we can decide when we'll die. But somehow all our defiance seems made of straw, and death seems unmoved and implacable. It doesn't seem cool to die young. It doesn't seem that the right to voluntary assisted suicide is such a great right to have. In the Bible, the writer of a book called Ecclesiastes puts his mind to the meaning of life, the universe and everything, but quickly and repeatedly comes up against the blank wall of death. If you give yourself to pleasure in life, it will end in death. If you give yourself to hard work and enterprise, you will die just as the person who is lazy and slothful. If you cultivate wisdom and knowledge and learning and understanding, you will die just like the fool. What's more, no matter how well you live your life, with what compassion or diligence or prudence, your heirs may be fools or sluggards or thieves, and everything you lived for at your death will pass to them. But in another part of the Bible, the prophet Isaiah speaks of a time when he says, the Lord God himself will swallow up death in victory and wipe away the tears from the eyes of the bereaved. And the prophet Hosea speaks of the sting of death being tamed and made harmless. And hundreds of years later, in the events of the first Easter, the first Good Friday, and the first Resurrection Sunday, these truths of the Bible come to their climax and resolution, the sting of death tamed, and the tears of the bereaved wiped away. Death is overwhelmed, swallowed up in victory, when the author of life, the Son of God, Jesus Christ, dies upon the cross, is laid in a tomb, and 3 days later, rises to live again and to live forever. Why Jesus among so many possibilities? Christians say, because there is only one victor over death. Jesus Christ, who said, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever lives and believes in me shall never die." John Donne was a Christian, a minister in the church, Dean of St. Paul's, as you might know, and his poem expresses the truth first written in the Bible that is at the heart of Christian confidence and Christian preaching. We say, "Death, be not proud. Christ is risen." Death, be not proud. Not by putting a good spin on a bad day, not by looking for a silver lining, not by claiming that those who die young avoid the trouble of old age. We say, "Death, be not proud, because Christ is risen. Death cannot hold us." As John Donne puts it at the end of his poem, "One short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die." But if you're a sceptic, you'll say, "Well, I've heard all this before. It's just wishful thinking. It's fine to think this way while we live. It helps the grieving. It helps the going on after we've been robbed of those we loved and lived with. But I'm not buying it. We'll rot in the ground. And that's all there is to it." And that is an entirely reasonable thing to say. To be sceptical about resurrection is perfectly understandable. As far as I know, there isn't any faith that claims to have any evidence for what it teaches about the afterlife, with one exception. There is no Buddhist who denies that the tomb of the Buddha is occupied. There is no Muslim who denies that the tomb of the Prophet is occupied. There is no Jew who denies that the tomb of Moses is occupied. But every Christian denies that the tomb of Jesus holds his bones. Christians proclaim, "Christ is risen. Death is swallowed up in victory." Why Jesus, among so many possibilities? Christians say, because there is only one victor over death, only one in all of human history who has conquered death and opened the way to life that endures to eternity. No one but Jesus, who says, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me will live even though they die." If you can believe Jesus, then there aren't many possibilities. But there is one. There is Jesus, raised from the dead, Lord of life. So I want to try and answer a couple of questions in the time we have left. Firstly, is it reasonable to believe that Jesus rose from the dead? And secondly, to think of the difference that that makes. Two aspects of the resurrection of Jesus that Matthew records for us to consider. The tomb was empty, and secondly, Jesus appeared. So firstly, the empty tomb. All four Gospels record that Jesus died on the day before the Sabbath, and that on the day after the Sabbath, Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of James, went to the tomb where they had seen Jesus buried and discovered that it was empty. It's not likely that they went to the wrong tomb. They'd been there the day before. If they had gone to the wrong tomb, someone would have said, "You've gone to the wrong tomb. He's over there." Nobody did that. Instead, Matthew records for us that the chief priests bribed the Roman guards to risk their lives by saying that the body had been stolen while they slept. That is to say, no one denied that the tomb was empty. The opponents of Jesus simply sought another way of explaining it, namely that the disciples stole the body. But why would the disciples steal the body? If they'd done that, what would they do with it? It makes no sense to say that they would start to proclaim that he was alive. The Gospels record that the disciples were very disinclined to believe that Jesus was alive. It makes more sense to say that they would have set him up in state for people to come and worship, to pay their respects, to say a prayer. When Lenin died, 10,000 people came in the first 3 days. Not John Lennon, the other one. The same thing happened when the Queen Mother died. The same thing happened when Elvis died. We don't like tall poppies, as we call them, in Australia, so I can't really think of anyone that we did that for, but a lot of people did turn up for a horse named Farlap. But they don't set up the body of Jesus. They begin to preach that he was alive. This was not a popular message. It didn't make them famous or influential. It was blasphemous to Jews. It was ludicrous to Greeks. And if you want to believe that the disciples stole the body, then you have to accept that the dramatic transformation of their character and their eventual deaths for the sake of this message came about despite knowing that it was a lie. It's true that people will die for things that are false, that they believe to be true. But who will die for what they know to be false? Then secondly, there is the evidence of the appearances, and there's two kinds of evidence for that, the witnesses and the change that came about in the disciples. The Apostle Paul lists a catalogue of witnesses of the resurrected Jesus. The Apostle Peter, the 12, 500 others. And this is intended to serve as evidence. Paul says in 1 Corinthians, in his first letter to the Corinthian church, written only 15 years or so after the death and resurrection of Jesus, he says most of these people are still alive. That is to say, you can go and talk to them about it. Check it out with them. They were there and they're still alive. There are a couple of alternatives to explain the appearances of Jesus other than as being resurrected in the body from the dead. One is that Jesus wasn't dead. And according to this scenario, he's close enough to dead that Joseph of Arimathea doesn't notice that he's alive when he takes him down from the cross and wraps him in burial clothes. But when Joseph places Jesus' body in the tomb, Jesus is refreshed. He stands on his pierced feet and with his pierced hands, rolls away the stone and overpowers the Roman guards. When he reaches the disciples, he's so impressive to them, they think he's conquered death and is the risen Son of God. And the sight of his crucified and disemboweled body so strengthens their resolve and fortifies their courage, they lose altogether the fear which had made them desert Jesus just days before and hide away behind locked doors afterwards. And instead, now, they turn the world upside down by their preaching that Jesus is raised from the dead. And Jesus doesn't stop them from doing this by saying, "Oh, I only fainted." The other explanation that is offered is that the appearances were hallucinations, which is in stark contrast to the sheer physicality of the gospel accounts. Women grasping the feet of Jesus, or the two disciples walking with him on the road to Emmaus, or the disciples eating fish with him by the Sea of Galilee. And this suggestion of a sort of hallucination involves something recorded before or since, namely mass hallucination of the same thing by different groups of people repeatedly over 40 days. And it begs the question why somebody didn't simply say, "His body's over there." The resurrection of Jesus from the dead is, of course, an utterly unprecedented event in human history. I don't want you to hear me suggesting that this is an obvious thing to believe. It isn't. Muslims deny that Jesus was crucified. Jews deny that he was raised from the dead. The ancient Greeks found the idea of the resurrection of the physical body an utterly unattractive view of the afterlife. The Buddhist doctrine of karma makes Jesus' death by crucifixion utterly incomprehensible.
How could such a beautiful life have warranted such a horrific death? The Buddhist will say. At no time has the Christian preaching of the resurrection been less than incredible. But the simple, straightforward, and rather unspectacular accounts continue to have power, it seems to me, because no one can deny that something happened. The preaching of the resurrection irrevocably changed the course of world history. Jesus left no instruction manual, no army, no strategic plan. Yet the group of disciples who took up the message that Jesus was raised from the dead, Lord and Judge of humankind and worthy to be worshipped as God, according to their own enemies, turned the world upside down, despite the fact that they were, for the most part, ordinary, unschooled men with no claim to religious authority or military power or political influence or economic resources. Gautama Buddha spent 50 years after his enlightenment establishing monastic centres to preserve and practice his teaching. The Prophet of Islam led military campaigns of conquest, established a dynasty within his own tribal and family structure, and left a book he claimed had been dictated by God. Jesus left a disparate collection of demoralised, frightened, and uneducated followers. Something profoundly and permanently changed them, so that global history continues to feel their impact today. The preaching of Jesus, crucified for sin and raised from the dead, created new communities within weeks of followers that were unlike any other community then or since. Communities that overcame deep-seated, long-standing historical divisions of race and gender and economic status. The Apostle Paul would write, "Here there is neither Jew nor Greek, neither male nor female, neither slave nor free." Today we call that inclusiveness. Then they called it heresy. And the people who believed it called themselves Christians. They changed their attitude to God, worshipping a man, Jesus Christ, as Lord and God. They changed their day of worship, stipulated in the ancient law of God handed down to Moses, from Saturday to Sunday, the day of resurrection. I don't know if St. Helens has ever tried to change its service times, how that went, but imagine changing the day of worship. They did it like that. They changed their attitude to the body and began to care for the diseased and the elderly and the disabled and infants in a way unknown in the ancient world. Even the Jews considered such people unclean. The ancient pagans simply discarded them. The early Christians changed their attitude to personal morality, to government, to work, to wealth, to marriage and the future. And many of the things that you regard as instinctive or obvious came from Christian impulses. The social and political effects of the early Christian movement were so dramatic, widespread and enduring, even in the first three centuries, that the former Lady Margaret Professor of Divinity at Cambridge, C.F.D. Moll, said, "There is a resurrection-shaped hole in history which remains an unsolved enigma for any historian who does not take seriously the explanation offered by the New Testament." I'm saying that the claim of Jesus is unique and therefore worthy of your consideration, because there is no prophet or sage or guru or messenger of whom it can be said, "He conquered death." And as unlikely as that is, I think there are good reasons for believing it. But that only answers the question why Jesus rather than any other religious view or none. But we need to consider why Jesus is important for each one of us personally. What is the significance? What is the meaning of resurrection? So three things to mention. Firstly, death is conquered. We're told that the women hurry away from the tomb, afraid yet filled with joy, and then Jesus appears to them. And Matthew tells us they came to him and clasped his feet and worshipped him.
Now, those who want to argue that the Christian faith is just too much of a good thing, too much of an answer to our deepest fears, they have a point. Fear of death is among the most long-standing and deeply felt fears we have. We fear death because it is inevitable, no matter how long we live or how productively or fruitfully. We fear death because it is mysterious, it is the last great unknown. We fear it because it robs us of the very thing that makes human life so rich and rewarding and satisfying. It robs us of relationship with others.
But from the perspective of the Bible, death is not only inescapable and impenetrable and ruthless. Worst of all, death is a penalty, an alien intrusion into God's world, not part of his intention for humankind, but the outcome of our deliberate rejection of his loving rule. Throughout Scripture, death is seen as divine judgment on human disobedience. So according to the Bible, we don't die merely because we're old or ill or unlucky, but because the world has been plunged into alienation from God, and to be alienated from God, to be separated from the source of life, is to die. God's plan was that we should know him and love him, love each other, love what is good, and enjoy doing it. But instead, we fall in love with ourselves. We fall in love with tiny little slivers of God's goodness, computers or shoes or fatty food or politics or music. And we fixate on these things and obsess over them, forgetting to notice or even hating what is dear to God, his Son, other people, truth, purity, faithfulness. And so we are pitted against one another, and we destroy the world, and as a result, everything is much shabbier and sadder than it could have been. And our lives reap what we have sown: death. But Christ died for our sins and was raised for our forgiveness, for a new beginning, to bring blessing to a world that has turned away from God, to renew the whole creation, and to wipe away every tear. Resurrection means death has been conquered. Secondly, resurrection means that everything matters. Because Jesus was raised in his body, the character of human life in the body is of importance. We are not merely spirits waiting to be liberated, but bodies that have their own dignity. And so a body emaciated by hunger, or disfigured by sickness, or maimed by violence, is not just an untouchable soul in a disposable packaging. God cares about people made from flesh and blood, and that is why Christians are called to do the same. But we're not merely flesh and blood. These bodies will be raised and transformed. We'll come to a resurrected Lord and Judge and give an account for this body and the life that we lived in it. Not the good intentions we had, but what we did with the flesh and blood entrusted to us. And the outcome will be to live with him forever or to be eternally sent away. And it was just this reality and crisis of accountability that energized the preaching of the disciples. The resurrection is hard to believe in. In some ways, Christianity's greatest apologetic challenge. But if that's true, then atheism's greatest challenge is to offer some meaning, some value for life. Resurrection means accountability, significance, value. But why should life matter if there is no God? If there is no God and death is the end, why is kindness better than cruelty, if cruelty pleases me better, or is more convenient, or cheaper? If a human is just one species among many species in a world that has come from nowhere and is going nowhere, why is the death of humans from war, famine, or poverty something to be concerned about? Why do humans have rights? Why should people be able to enjoy free speech or clean water or education? Why should those who have such things worry about those who don't? Chances are you're a person who's concerned for justice and truth and beauty. Why? The typical response of contemporary atheism is to say that life doesn't require meaning, or at least it's enough for someone to create their own meaning. But atheist philosopher Bertrand Russell was perhaps more radically honest about the prospect of creating personal meaning in the absence of God. He said this: all the labour of the ages, all the devotion, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction, and the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. Only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. Which at least explains the reason philosophers are so lonely. By all means, create your own meaning. But for Russell, at least, you may only do so on the foundation of unyielding despair. But in fact, such foundations are illusory. In an article in the Atlantic magazine titled How to Land Your Kid in Therapy, psychologist Laurie Gottlieb says she has a steady stream of clients in their 20s and 30s who have strong friendships, supportive families, and a deep sense of unhappiness. She says they're unhappy while knowing they have nothing to be unhappy about. They describe themselves as having supportive parents, awesome friends, an excellent education, good health, a nice apartment, and yet are unable to sleep at night. They suffer from depression and anxiety. They have difficulty choosing and committing to a satisfying career path and feel a sense of emptiness and lack of purpose. They feel adrift, as though they had a hole inside them. Inescapably unsatisfying in the absence of purpose and meaning. But because of the resurrection, we can say there is recognition of all the compassion and heroic service that in this life goes unrecognized or even scorned. There will be justice for all the evil that in this life goes unpunished. There is vindication of faithful perseverance, and there'll be judgment upon wickedness among humans and defiance of God. So everything matters. Lastly, the significance of the resurrection is that it proclaims Jesus as King of God's kingdom. The kingdom has arrived in Jesus' victory over death. Jesus appears to his disciples in Matthew 28 and says, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me." Why Jesus among many possibilities? No one, no other religious teacher is so incredibly egocentric and at the same time self-sacrificial. The kingdom is still to come in all of its world-transforming fullness. This world still labours under its alienation from God, poverty and suffering and disease and greed and sin. But it will not be so forever. This world is between resurrection and kingdom come. Death holds sway for the moment, but its final end has been proclaimed in the resurrection of Jesus. And through faith in him, those who die will live again and live forever. In Australia, we've got a television program, a panelist sort of program called Q&A, questions and answers. And it was broadcast recently from a couple of years ago from a festival of dangerous ideas. The host posed the last question: which so-called dangerous idea has the greatest potential to change the world for the better if it were implemented? Gay activist Dan Savage said, "Population control. I'm pro-choice, but in my darker moments I'm anti-choice. I think abortion should be mandatory for about 30 years. The English feminist Germaine Greer. You can have her. The dangerous idea that terrifies us the most, that we think of as most dangerous, is freedom. But the English journalist Peter Hitchens, brother of the late Christopher Hitchens, said this: "The most dangerous idea in human history and philosophy remains the belief that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and rose from the dead. That is the most dangerous idea you will ever encounter." The host prompted him to elaborate, so Hitchens continued, "It's dangerous because it alters the whole of human behaviour and all our responsibilities. It turns the universe from meaningless chaos into a designed place in which there is justice and there is hope, and therefore we all have the duty to discover the nature of that justice and work towards that hope. It alters us all. If we reject it, it alters us as well. It is incredibly dangerous." Which means that Jesus really is the unavoidable issue. You can avoid any wise man, any thinker or sage or philosopher, but you cannot avoid the man who claims victory over death and authority over life. You can reject it, but it cannot be ignored. It cannot be treated as a sidelight. You might think of it as the very central issue of life. Because Jesus is raised from the dead, his claim alone to be able to forgive sin, his claim alone to be able to grant life eternally, his claim alone to be Lord and judge of all, stand. Because Jesus is raised, we will all be raised. Because Jesus is raised from the dead, victor, judge, Lord of all, Jesus is life's unavoidable issue. None of us will avoid death. Won't you? Won't you? Won't you consider Christ? Amen.